Welcome to Going Deep, Sports in the 21st Century on Blue Ridge Public Radio. I'm Dr. Marcia Mount Shoup.
And I'm Coach John Shoup.
John's coached at the highest levels of the game of football for 26 years.
And Marcia is an author, theologian, and minister.
And we're glad you've joined us to go deep into some of the most pressing issues of our time.
On Going Deep, we go beyond the sound bites and highlight reels.
Hello, I'm Matt Bush, the news director for Blue Ridge Public Radio. I also produce Going Deep with the Shoups, and in this episode, we discuss our host's appearance on the HBO documentary Student Athlete. It's now showing and can be viewed anytime with HBO's various streaming services. Student Athlete was produced in part by Spring Hill Entertainment, which was co-founded by LeBron James. Its director is Oscar winner Charmaine Obaid-Chinoy. Student Athlete examines the rules of amateur athletics in America and how they affect uncompensated athletes and their families. We start our conversation today with the Shoups explaining how they became involved in the project while John was coaching at Purdue University.
It was in the middle of a big, kind of intense few weeks for us. It was right after John was fired at Purdue, and that whole situation was pretty intense. It was a pretty intense few weeks that led up to that firing. We had been involved in some discussion there around head injuries and also economic justice. Paying players was an issue we had tried to discuss with the athletic director at Purdue, Morgan Burke. And so it was, you know, it was a shock when John got fired, and it was pretty clear that our stances on these things had impacted the university's decision to let him go. So Joe Nocera at the New York Times did a story on what happened at Purdue with John's job, and that is where Trish Dalton and Charmaine Obaid-Chinoy heard about us. And so they basically reached out to you directly, Charmaine did. And Charmaine is an Academy Award-winning director. She had actually just won an Academy Award for her movie on honor killings in Pakistan. So I can't even remember, did she email you or call you? And I remember us talking on the phone with them. But
Charmaine and Trish called me, is what I remember. And the New York Times article was really kind of quite frustrating to me. And it was really a hard time because it went into a lot of things that I didn't even realize, you know, Joe Nocera had investigated that really had a hand in my firing. If you remember, it went back to when the Missouri football players protested at their school, and there were people throughout the country taking pictures of standing with the Missouri football players. Well, that week we were playing Northwestern, and the quarterbacks and I took a picture to stand with the players at Missouri. And it was that week, with about 5 weeks left in the season, that a reporter who covers Purdue athletics called you, Marcia.
Called me, yeah.
Didn't even call me. Called Marcia and said, I'm so sorry, but John is going to be fired at the end of the year. And I immediately went into the head coach and said, why is this lady calling my wife and tell her I'm fired. What's going on? And he denied everything. That's certainly not the case.
You're doing a great job.
But I had argued with our athletic director about head injuries before. I had argued with our committee on eligibility, you know, the NCAA liaison about getting two players eligible that were ineligible. And I can remember being called in to the head coach's office and being told, you can't fight a billion-dollar business, John. What are you doing? And so it led to a bunch of things that came out in the article that I didn't even realize. Kind of Joe found things out in investigating. And so then Charmaine and Trish, the directors, called me, and they said they wanted to do a story. And Charmaine doesn't know if a football is pumped or stuffed. She's never been a football fan in any way, shape, or form, but she knows about
human
social
rights.
Justice and human rights. And we just had a long conversation, and it wasn't about football. And, you know, Joe Noceri used to tell me, he used to say, you know, as far as issues go, you know, I'm not sure the NCAA and college sports is the biggest. And I always argued with him on that point because I said, you know, in college sports, we're talking about issues of race. We're talking about issues of health and health care. We're talking about public education.
Economic justice.
Economic justice. I'm not sure there's bigger issues in the world. Maybe it's just a microcosm for how we deal with it. And that's really kind of what Charmaine and Trish conveyed to me, that this isn't as much about sports as it is about social justice, and it attracted me to it. And I took some time to think about it, and we took some time to think about it, and I kind of looked at some of the work Charmaine had done, and she now has 2 Academy Awards. At the time, she had 1, and I thought, you know, if someone's going to tell this story, this is a pretty good person to tell it, I think.
Another piece of this, it's kind of an interesting serendipity, interesting example of serendipity, is that I had been to a conference, the CSRI conference, and that is Collegiate Sports Research Institute. And I had spoken at that conference and presented a paper, and I met a former player named Bob DeMars there. He played for USC. And
Southern Cal, USC.
Yeah, he had just finished a documentary called The Business of Amateurs. And at the conference, we had a screening of that, and it's an excellent movie, and you should watch it. And so I invited Bobby to come to Purdue. I said, this is such a good movie. We'd love to have an event where we can get you and some players on a panel and talk about head injuries and economic issues. This was...
While I was still working.
John was still coaching at Purdue. So when I got back to West Lafayette, I called Morgan Burke, the athletic director. He and I had had many conversations. He had read my book. He was somebody who I felt like I had a positive relationship with. And I told him about the movie, and I told him how excited I was that Purdue has this concussion study going on here, that we could really look like the knight in shining armor coming in, have this event, talk about concussions, really take a leadership stand on this. He said, I will talk about concussions, but I'm not touching this movie because it talks about paying players. And they should not be paid. They are given so much. I mean, it was clear that he and I had really, really different concepts of, and he said, I can't tell you what to do, but I'm not going to participate if you use this movie. And I said, okay, well, I will prayerfully consider that, and I really do hope you'll change your mind. But my feeling is that we're going to go ahead and have the event. And that conversation happened just a few weeks before John was fired, too. And when we did go on and have that event, which is depicted in the documentary, part of that event is depicted in the documentary, we had invited Purdue players to come, and the team at the last minute scheduled a mandatory meeting on a Sunday so that none of them could attend. So it was a very intense time, and it was a big decision to actually say yes to Charmaine and Trish, because we knew that this was just another step of us taking a stand that wasn't gonna play well with the powers that be, not just at Purdue, but in revenue collegiate sports in general. So it was kind of a big step. I remember us really kind of having to deeply discern what, you know, how we wanted to orient ourselves to her ask.
Her prior work focused on human rights.
Yes.
Things like honor killings, very, very horrific crimes and issues in areas outside of the United States. How does this, collegiate athletics, 70,000 people going to a football game on a Saturday like this, how does that fit into the same discussion of human rights?
Well, and that's what convinced John and me when we talked to Charmaine. She said, this is a human rights issue. She really felt in her research and understanding of the issues, and there's something really startling when you're in the world of football to talk to somebody who's so not in the world of football. I mean, she lives in Pakistan. She's not American. And so she's looking at these dynamics and saying, what in the world are you telling me? You know, these players are a part of a $1 billion business, and many of them are from families under the poverty line. They don't have money to eat. They're living, they had already started talking to some of these players too, and some of them were living in their cars. You know, a lot of them had mental health issues. And so for her, the narrative pretty quickly clicked into her human rights sensitivities. It just, she didn't have any equivocation about that at all.
The collegiate model of amateurism is so American. If you talk to anybody in Europe, and she's from Pakistan, as she said, when you explain it to them, they're like, you've got to be kidding me. You know, and if you think of it, if you're a reasonable person, and say you work for a company, and your boss made $100 million, and with that $100 million, he bought a house, a mansion, a beach house, 2 yachts, 5 Rolls Royces, every posh, luxurious item you could think of, and then at the end of the fiscal year said to you, I'm sorry, I don't have enough money to pay you. You'd think that's crazy. In a nutshell, that's kind of what the rest of the world looks at the collegiate amateur model and thinks. And so her lens looking at it being un-American, her not being an American, actually, I think, lent weight to my thought of, yeah, you know, you're right. It is that messed up. I'm glad it feels messed up to someone else.
Does it really take someone not being from the United States to get that? I think you were sort of hinting at that kind of, Marcia, of the collegiate structure for mm-hmm. these sports is just so ingrained
it's
in
so
American
ingrained.
Culture that it does it really take people from outside of the United States to look at this and see the things that this documentary is bringing up and that you've discussed, the problems with it?
I think you can see it, but we don't want to see it. I mean, in the America, and the part of what the film really shows you, and it's heartbreaking, is how deep the narrative is. Even for the players that are living in their cars. I mean, they still feel really a love for the sport. This is the narrative they grew up with, that this is their way, this is their ticket, not just to money, but to an education, to a better life than their families had, a way to help their family. And even when they get there and realize, like the coaches get all this money, the university gets all this money, and they're giving me shoes and a sweatsuit, but I don't have any money to eat, you know. And I can't even sleep at a person's house that's offering me a place to sleep. I've got to sleep in my car, or that's an NCAA violation. because that narrative is so deeply ingrained in all of us, it is. It's hard to snap out of that and look at it objectively. The other narratives that it really hooks into, and people don't want to talk about this and we're not even conscious of it sometimes, is the narrative that people of color should just be grateful to be in white spaces and to have any kind of benefit from a white institution. So there's something about race in here that's deeply ingrained around, well, you're not really expecting to get the same thing the rest of us get, right? That's a tough thing for people to name as well. And I would add that one of the kind of difficult parts of the journey for John and me has been realizing how while we were in it, we justified it. We justified, like, well, gosh, you know, you work 18 hours a day. You have to deal with all this stress and the press and people yelling at you. And I have to deal with stress and we have to move all the time. And there were all these ways that we felt like, you know, it's fair. It's fair that we make all this money and the players are getting an education. There were ways that we, too, tried to ingest that narrative that made us feel okay about it. And I'm embarrassed about that when I look back at it. I'm ashamed that it took us experiencing kind of disadvantage and being kind of cast out for us to be like, you know what? This is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. But if things had gone differently for us, if I hadn't met Bobby DeMars, or if the NCAA investigation hadn't happened at UNC, I have to be honest with myself, we could still be in it and be saying, you know, this is great. And that's a hard thing for me to say out loud.
It's easy to point out all the problems, and I think that I did see many of them while I was coaching, because I was wrestling with getting guys eligible. And that's where I kind of spent my time, on the injustice of the thing. Why is this guy ineligible? This guy should be eligible.
In due process,
and these guys taking classes that they want to take. But the thing that I was maybe a little blinded to, not a little, that I was blinded to while I was in it, was how so many of these young men live in poverty, and what we could do for this country if these guys just took home, or were able to send home or back into their community, some of this money that they make for the coaches. And it's hard. It's easy to talk about. But when someone gives you a check for a lot of money, it's hard to change your view. It's hard to see those things. Money was seductive, and, you know, I don't like to admit it, but it's seductive, and it keeps you from maybe seeing things as they are at times.
Yeah.
It's very biblical, I must say.
Yes, it is. Definitely prophetic.
You just got back from New York, where you're at the premiere of the documentary, and you talked to quite a few people up there, some mm-hmm. names people won't know, a few that people will.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about some of the people that you interacted with while you're up there, and kind of what you got from talking to them.
We went to New York City, and the premiere was in the new museum down in the Lower East Side, not far from NYU. And it was really an amazing event. And we did meet a lot of neat people, but one person that made a really strong impression on me was Maurice Clarett.
The one name I think a lot of people might know. He was running back at Ohio State. Was on their national championship team in 2002 that won the national championship, and he was sort of the star player. He was a freshman. And that was sort of the pinnacle of his career, because after that a lot happened regarding the NCAA and the NFL too with him. So tell us more about your chat with him.
Yeah, well, Maurice was as authentic and kind of raw of a person as I can remember meeting. There was no pretense, and he said exactly what he thought. And one of the things that really made an impact on me was after the movie, he came right up to me and he kind of jabbed his finger in my chest and he said, "You know what? We need more white people telling the world what this problem is." And he told me that's what courage is. And it was probably the greatest compliment I could get, because I was kind of feeling, you know, it ain't easy to see yourself on a movie screen, and I'm a little bit nervous, wondering how I'm going to come off. And, you know, I can remember I leaned over to Marshall, "Why was I wearing that shirt? And my hair's not combed, or, you know, I look like my glasses are crooked. You know, do I really sound like that?" All of that goes through. And then at the end, when you're kind of feeling a little bit vulnerable, to have Maurice, who's seen fire and rain, because Maurice is also, you know, he was the number one high school recruit in the country coming out. He goes to Ohio State, and as a freshman, they win the national championship. He tries to leave college early and go to the NFL. They won't let him go. He petitions them. He gets in trouble. He's arrested for armed robbery. He spends 4 years in prison. All the while, I didn't realize he and LeBron James are, like,
Brothers, really
close friends, and
from
grew
the same
up
area,
together.
LeBron from Akron, Maurice is from Youngstown.
Yeah,
near each other there in Eastern Ohio.
And Maurice was struggling with some mental health issues. Yeah,
and so we had talked to him for a period before the movie, but for him to find me after the movie and say that to me was about, you know, on time.
Yeah.
I really needed that.
And we hope to have him on Going Deep sometime, because he's doing some really amazing work now with young men of color around mental illness. And he's really on a mission to make sure that they are provided the services that they need to be healthy and to be a healthy part of communities. And he really felt like after the movie, you know, he's like, "I've experienced pretty much all of that, every different part of the different stories of the players that they tell in the movie." He's like, "I almost every single bit of that, that's me."
And I also remember Maverick Carter, who's the CEO of Spring Hill Entertainment, which is LeBron James' entertainment company, and Steve Stout, who's one of their producers, both African-American men. I can remember them sitting up, and I would say that the room watching it was probably 50%, if not more, people of color.
More than that, yeah.
Yeah, more than that. And I can remember them standing up after the movie. And I think it was the first time in my life that I really felt the anger that people had regarding amateurism in the collegiate model. You know, when you experience it with college athletes, you see the sorrow, you see the hurt, you see the pain. But when I was in Manhattan and Steve started talking, one of the producers, and Maverick started talking, let me tell you, there were four-letter words coming out, and they were just telling you this was slavery. This is slavery today. And do the people in this room have the courage to fight this? And to hear someone just not tone it down, not speak to the audience, not, "Hey, I'm going to try to be politically correct," but to hear someone get mad in the whole room start getting mad with them, that really had an impact on me that I've always kind of thought, you know, this is bad, and I've seen the sorrow. in amateurism. I don't know that I've ever seen the anger quite like I saw it there. People are angry about this. And these men, LeBron James, Maverick Carter, Steve Stout, Jamal Henderson, the president of Spring Hill, Charmaine, these men and women, they don't like seeing young men of color being taken advantage of the way they are. Mm-hmm. And son of a gun, they're fighting back.
When people watch this, what do you hope they take out of it?
My prayer for it really is that they begin to dismantle these mentalities about collegiate athletes, that they get everything, that they just get everything they want, and they're so entitled, and nobody ever tells them no. And, I mean, these young men are good soldiers. They're playing the part. They're following the script that they have been taught. And this is not just a few. This is thousands and thousands and thousands of young men who think this is the journey, this is the path they've got to walk. And then about 3% of them even get a shot to be in the NFL. And then that number goes way down into who can actually make a career out of that and accumulate wealth that stands the test of time. So it's a lie. It's a myth. And it's built on the backs of communities of color, not just the young men, but their families, their communities that put all this hope in them, that put all this, you know, these aspirations of this is going to be the way things change for us. I would hope that people could see that movie and begin to dismantle that narrative and see the faces of these young men, how hard they are working, and hear, you know, John's voice. I mean, John's voice in the movie is really almost like a narrator, like, this is what's happening right here. And it sounds crazy, but it's true. This is what is happening. And I would hope it would shake some people loose enough to begin to put pressure on their universities. Everybody makes the NCAA out to be the evil empire. They're nothing without the universities. The universities do what the NCAA tells them to do. Without the universities, there is no NCAA. And alumni, the alumni that are so rabid about their teams, if they start to not like this system, it'll change. It'll change. I can guarantee you it'll change. So I pray that there can be some kind of shaking loose of the narrative that makes this conversation a non-starter for people. Most people are like, tell me about something that I should really care about. And this is something you should really care about. If you care about economic justice in the rest of your life, but you don't let that touch that game that you watch every Saturday or the basketball games you watch, then you've got a real blind spot. And this is an important issue. That's my prayer, that it can somehow help people wake up to that.
Sometimes good art, no matter what it is, whether it's a song, a movie, a poem, makes you feel something, makes you feel what the artist feels. And I hope that people feel kind of what Marcia and I have felt over the years, that while there's so much money in college sports, there's so many young men that are living hard, hard lives. And the coaches, the administrators, the ADs, the TV execs are making money off their back. And it's not uncommon for people, white people from privilege, often to say to me, well, gosh, you know, if we just paid these players, what would they spend their money on? Watch this movie. You know what they'd spend their money on? Rent. You know what they'd spend their money on? Clothes and food. Is there going to be a guy that spends it unwisely occasionally? Yeah, there is. Just like
a trust fund kid can do that too.
Just like someone who buys a gold toilet or something does and is, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There are, but the bulk of the people, when I watched this movie, I'd never met any of the other characters, but I knew each one of them. I knew them. I could put names with them. I had faces with them. I knew every single one of them. And I hope that people, as they watch this, think of those young men. And don't necessarily think of the maybe 1 in 20 or 1 in 25 that, yeah, if they had money, they'd do something stupid with it.
This is something I've asked before, but I want to ask it again in this context of what we were discussing. Why do the universities that we've gone to, the University of the South and Vanderbilt for you, John, Center College for you, Marcia, Point Park and American for me, but not just for us, for so many others, thousands upon thousands of people, why do the universities we go to have such a hold on us where you know from your time in North Carolina when the scandal went down what happened and how people wanted to protect the school, not the people.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly happened at Penn State. It happened at Baylor. It happened at all these other places across the country. Why is it that universities have such a hold on the people who have gone to them and even not gone to them? I mean, you and I have discussed, John, you and I didn't go to Pitt, but the school means a lot to us because that's who we rooted for as children. Why do these schools have such a hold on us?
Well, there are a few ways to answer that question. I mean, one is institutional idolatry. You know, we create gods, you know, little g gods, things that we give infinite status because they help us understand who we are. Universities, not only do kids kind of grow up wanting to be a part of that community, but kids grow up kind of getting meaning around what their family cares about or what their state is about or what, you know, what colors they like or whatever it is. It's a sense of belonging and a sense of meaning that universities give us. And it's also a way to kind of organize the universe. Here are my friends and here are my enemies. And so we give it in a kind of infinite status. We need it to be beyond reproach. We need it to be something that we can trust. And so when we need that, we become blind. We don't see the flaws. And it's because with those flaws comes our whole kind of concept of ourselves and the world and what makes sense and what makes us feel good. And so institutional idolatry is just when we've created a kind of narrative that allows us to give our universities, these institutions, a kind of moral pass because there's too much at stake not to. And you see that play out in sports so much. And the interesting thing about sports is that it helps to kind of reify all that. It helps to make it really deeply entrenched because we get to perform it and act it out on a regular basis. And we get ways to measure and quantify it with scores and records and players and recruiting and ticket sales and all that stuff that there's actually a way to dig it even more deeply into our value system. We spend our money on it. We spend our time on it. There's something about that, though, that I still believe, even after everything we've been through, that you can harness it for good. And that's what I was saying a few minutes ago. Take that energy, that love, that fierce loyalty, and get those people upset about something that actually matters And something is going to change. And that's what was so disappointing. I think about what happened at North Carolina is how quickly the players who were disadvantaged by the NCAA investigation became outsiders. Like, there was no sense in which, don't come after our people. Those are our people. There was like, no, you're not our people anymore. And so I hope that's not what happens here. I actually said to Charmaine Obaid while we were there, she goes, oh, this is going to be great, and this is going to really make an impact. I said, are you ever on Twitter? I said, you could look at what some people have been saying on my page lately. You know, you're poking a giant here. And she said, yeah, but we're doing it with stories, and we're doing it with art, and it's not just words. It's people are going to have an experience. And I really hope she's right. I really hope she's right. I went off a little bit, but on the what is your feeling about universities and why?
Well, at universities and in the NFL, I mean, there have been times when I've been interacting with fans, alumni, and I've really thought to myself, "You care way too much. This is a little weird. This is." Overboard. And it has caused discomfort. I mean, your book is amazing, talking about institutional idolatry and fanaticism, and it's right on. I can't tell you why exactly, but I can tell you I have personally experienced discomfort in the NFL and in college. I'm not talking about fans just yelling at me or something. Even in good times, like, fans just, this insatiable desire to just know what's going on behind the scenes. It's really was always uncomfortable to me. And I can remember thinking often, man, you might have to pump the brakes or chill out a little bit. You know?
You've been listening to Going Deep, Sports in the 21st Century, from the studios of Blue Ridge Public Radio, NPR for Western North Carolina. Tell us what you think of the show by emailing us at goingdeep@bpr.org. Make sure to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter as well, @ShoopsGoingDeep.